welcome to our new Mick Artistics Ego podcast. We'll be bringing you chat, insight, nonsense, laughter, music and a few surprises. And you can find out about our current activities and gigs, release news at mickartistic.com and on Facebook at Mick Artistics Ego Trip, as well as plenty of footage on our YouTube channel. And you can follow us on Twitter at Mick Artistic, at Johnny Ego Trip and at Ego Trip News. And today's guest is Jeff Hordley. Jeff Hordley, also known as Kane Dingle from the ITV soap Emmerdale, is an actor and is known as the baddie of the show. He's been in the cast for 20 years. At the 2007 British Soap Awards, he was nominated for Sexiest Male, Villain of the Year and Best Exit. And in today's show, we'll be talking about courgette cake, snow business, the beta band, the Brudenell Social Club, DJing in the 90s in Manchester, drama school, working alongside his wife Zoe on Emmerdale, and how Kane Dingle is less of a maverick these days.
I'm eating courgette cake. I've never had courgette cake in my life, and it's very pleasant. It's very subtle. It doesn't have loads of sugar in it, which I like.
Yeah.
But I'm being polite. I'm sitting here enjoying the subtleties of courgette cake.
Eat our cake. Well, we have an allotment, which we're very proud of, and we... it's not far from here, actually. And there's a ton of courgettes at the moment, so it's things to do. We're pickling courgettes. We're obviously eating courgettes the kind of traditional way.
Maybe so a pickled courgette is a gherkin, is it?
No. Well, no, a pickled gherkin is a cucumber.
All right. Okay.
A courgette pickled is, as far as I'm aware, is just pickled courgette.
Right.
I could be wrong. You're looking at me as if you've got that wrong, Jeff.
I'm looking at this well-tended garden and feeling inspired, but I just look at lovely stuff like this because I don't have green fingers.
Right, yeah.
My partner, she does stuff with pots and buddleias and these tiny little Japanese trees and stuff.
Yeah.
And she's deadly. She's just wonderful. And I kill plants. People give me plants and I just...
Oh, no, I kill them. Don't you worry. I sometimes things go wrong on the allotment, but the garden I can't take much credit for because we have a wonderful gardener who comes in and helps us out. So he kind of commands this space for us and makes it look great. But the allotment is all our own doing. And it's all a bit of trial and error. But like I say, we've got courgette at the moment, which brings us back to the courgette cake. And Zoe, my wife, found a recipe the other day. You know, you've got carrot cake, which is a lot sweeter.
And then this hit me now. Yeah. It's like a real, it's almost like a hit sort of orange.
Or there's a lemon zest on the top.
Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah, that went in then. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all right. So I thought I'd share some courgette cake with you.
Cake's good.
So this is the great British Ego Trip pub. Clamped down bake off. Right, this is everything. It boils down to a piece of cake.
Years ago I went on a cookery course and there was a guy on it and we made a garden salad on day one from the cookery course's allotment as well, and it was a cucumber, and he put his hand up and he said, "Oh, I've never had cucumber, I'll give that a go." And he must have been in his mid-30s. I'm thinking, how do you avoid cucumber that long? And what do you expect? It's just water, isn't it?
Well, this is where the allotment, and I sound like an allotment snob here, but you know when you'll have heard this from many people, the taste of my tomatoes from my allotment. When you picked them yourself and you've grown them yourself on your allotment. However, there are certain vegetables that you grow on the allotment, and a cucumber is a prime example of it. I've given plenty to friends. Mm. There might even be one still in the fridge that we picked the other day, so I'll pass one on to you, but they're quite, from a supermarket, they're quite tasteless, aren't they? And just kind of watery and...
Well, they're nothing.
They are nothing.
I mean, they're more like something decorative you stick on top of you.
Yeah.
You slice them really fine and you just lob them on. And,
yeah.
And,
but your homegrown ones
people
are
have
sweet.
Cucumbers. They used to have cucumber sandwiches and you think, well, what are they eating?
Well, you taste the butter of the bread, don't you? But a cucumber sandwich, you know.
Mm.
And our cucumbers taste... very sweet.
Ah, interesting, yeah.
Okay. And I don't know whether it's because we're not mass producing them or we're not putting any pesticides on them, but they do taste a lot better. Or whether it's just because you're hacking them straight away and you're eating them within a day or so.
So yeah. how do you really? What do you do? Do you go in with a knife and just kind of have the ground?
No, they're like a vine plant. So I've got a polytunnel, and inside there'll be tomatoes, there'll be chilies, there'll be cucumbers, and what else have I got in there? I've got lots of other, just things that like the heat. But the cucumbers, they're like on a vine, so they go everywhere.
All right, so they're sticking out.
Yeah, and you have to kind of put posts in and string, and you have to tie them up to that. And then they just kind of hang down. And then you just kind of snip them with scissors and take them off. Whatever size you want to let them grow. If you want them to grow big, leave them on for long. If you want them kind of nice and small, then just...
We might have to get a photograph of some of those.
We'll put them on the podcast.
Yeah, that's the sound of a ball bouncing in Jeff Hordley's garden, and that's the sound of the dog listening to the ball, the echo of the ball.
My son and his friend have just come out. They've just been watching a film together, and they've decided to come out and bounce on the trampoline. And now that they're kind of skulking away now, as if like they've disturbed
us. Because they've been pointed out. there's a curiosity there, but it's a sly curiosity. So how are your kids handling this 3 months of lockdown? How's everybody handling?
There's been highs and there's been lows, but generally I've found the we've found as a family the stopping of everything has been there's some positives in there for us as a family, because we live in a place that's kind of semi-rural, so we have these lovely little kind of walks where you didn't see many people, so you could be quite, you know, you can go for an isolated dog walk, and we'd go for an hour, say, with the dog and just the four of us, and just chat a lot. So, you know, I've got a 12-year-old son who's just started high school, and I've got
Stan,
and I've got Violet, who's just about to, she's going into a GCSE year this year. So, you know, it's been really good as a family to have, I knew that would happen. It's not my agent.
We met Stan 2 days ago. Me and my sister Margaret were in town having a coffee outside a Pret a Manger, and Jeff went past with his red, unobtrusive woolly hat on.
Yes.
And glasses. I thought I'd say something to him, and then I said something to him, and my sister Margaret was like going into a sort of a catatonic fit or something. And my mother said, "Oh, Kane, what, you're going to see Kane tonight?" I said, "I am, I'm off to see Kane tonight." But Margaret was like, and then you very gallantly said, "Oh, we'll do a little film, you know, if you want, you know, just." And I think the film never turned out or something.
Oh, you're
joking. We got like a snap of you, kind of like the segment of your face and like a bit of your jacket or something. But, you know, my sister was made up, you know. So it's going the rounds around Nabwood,
right?
This story. But
That never happened.
So tell us, you've had 3 months, and it's been like what?
There's been highs and lows, because I think for my children as well, they've reacted to it in different ways at different times. My aunt asked she's a great aunt actually. She's called my aunt Auntie Suze, and she really teases the best out of the children, because she speaks to them on as an adult would speak to them. So she asked my son, it was about 3 weeks ago, what's been the best thing about lockdown, and my son said getting Ronald the dog, because we managed to get a puppy at the beginning of the lockdown, and he's been a great focus for Stan whenever he's been feeling a wee bit kind of down or just frustrated that he's not seeing his mates. The dog's been a real lift for him. Whereas my daughter, she said, "And Violet, what's been the worst thing about lockdown for you?" And she's very honest, and she said it so straight and true. She just said, "Spending too much time with my family." But she was only being honest, and my auntie didn't kind of react and go, "Oh, that's not very nice." She went, "Yeah, well, that's and she, you know, she was only being honest, and it's been hard for us all, because we're not used to being in the four walls together 24/7.
Common story, I think.
Well, that's for example, Johnny's on his own. He manages on his own. How the hell he does? I'm there with my partner of 22 years.
Yeah.
Me and her, older people, whatever, sitting in a terrace in Armley.
Yeah.
And with three cats milling around. Yeah. That's us. And yet there's, and I often wonder about sort of my friends and people who have got kids. How do you stay sane when you've got like, you know, children 12, 13, 14? How do you keep a sort of a happy ship? You know.
I think for us, we've been lucky that we've got this like lovely outside space here, and we live in this area where we can go for walks. So I think that kept us sane. And going back to what we're talking about earlier, the plants and the allotment, I found, without sounding all kind of hippie about it, but just literally putting my hands in the earth and watching life grow has been a really positive thing for me. Mm-hmm. It's only been in close quarters with it during this lockdown that's made me realise what a wonderful thing it is to have that allotment and to watch life grow. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend of mine, and I went to see my mate up in Roundy, called Bankside Pete, who's a clown, and he made some coffee for me, and we were sitting there, and he started to talk about some obscure film or something, and he's full of crazy nonsense, and I was just distracted by this little bee that just floated just out of stage right, and it was just going into like a flower, and I looked at it, I thought, you know, that's amazing.
Mm.
It kind of stopped me in my tracks for about, like, I'm thinking, you know, just the grandeur of this planet. You don't have to have, you could just kind of look out and you've got this vast blue above you that has got sort of subtle shifts and colours and that, and it's grand, you know. And we don't, because we're sort of running around trying to pay the bills and trying to get our kids here or trying to get, you know, go through some golden door in our career or something. It's like, well, there's so much kind of treasure
already
that's
there,
you know. Yeah. And I think, well, just talking to Johnny on the way, that I think there's going to be stuff like political parties are going to have to change. The shift of people like sort of the Tories and Labour and the Liberals, whatever, that they can't fob us off with, oh, you know, we're going to have sort of socialism or with Thatcherism or something, you know, that because this has really kind of laid waste to so many sort of like, sort of old sort of pillars of sort of thought, you know.
Mm.
It's you know, it's like ground zero now almost.
Well, we've all experienced it. We've been through it all together, haven't we? Whether you're, I know that there's varying degrees of how people will have dealt with it, but generally we've all been affected by this as a planet. So that creates a commonality for everyone, doesn't it? Do you know what I mean? That they can all relate to, albeit, you know, I know that some people will have had some really tough times in this, because I kind of think of, what about, like yourself, I've thought, my friend who was just trying to ring then, actually, who's a musician yourself, like yourselves, and he's had gigs lined up and he's had to cancel them, and he's been in his flat in Manchester on his own, you know. But we spoke on, we kind of did a lot of those Zoom calls.
Yeah.
And had a few little pockets of friends that we did Zoom calls every week.
We're all Zoomers.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? But that also taught me something as well, the whole Zoom thing, because there was a certain set of, there was some friends that lived down in Oxford or near Oxford, and we always kind of put something in the diary once a year, and sometimes something might come up and one of us goes, we'll have to cancel this one date that we've set. And we always go, but when we see each other, it's like, they're the kind of friends that we just pick up. There's no like, oh, I haven't heard from you for a while. They're
just
good mates.
Click straight with them,
But we did a Zoom call with them, and we just literally we said 7 o'clock, and then it was literally 1 o'clock in the morning, about two bottles of wine later.
Yeah.
But we just all had a really good catch up, and it just made me go, yeah, that's what we can do. If ever in the future we can't make that trip to Oxford or they can't make it up here,
we'll just Zoom.
It's pushed we'll just Zoom. So that's a, that's a positive, isn't it?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
That's a new t-shirt. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll just Zoom.
We'll just Zoom.
So I guess filming's all off at the moment, is it?
No, filming is back.
Is it back on?
Filming is back on.
Have you been back on set? Or?
I've been back on set. I was... They were really keen not to go off air, I think, because I just think they wanted to keep it going because they had so much in the can.
So it hasn't got... So basically,
it's kept going, but they've pulled some of the episodes out just so that out of the schedule. So normally you'd get 6 episodes on a week on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, one double episode or whatever. And they've stripped that back to 3. So whereas they had, say, 4 weeks ahead with 6 episodes a week, they stripped it back to 3, therefore they had 8 weeks ahead. So that gave them a bit of time. But then they came up with an idea to write these 2-handers about lockdown.
Oh.
Of which I was asked to do one with Danny Miller, and that was great. It was we shot a whole episode in a day, socially distant. We were, as far as I'm aware.
So were you involved in the writing of it? Or
no, no, I wasn't involved in the writing of
so
it.
So Danny
plays Aaron. So it was about Kane and Aaron in lockdown, and he talked about his relationship, and I talked about mine, but in a kind of. In the life of the characters, because they're not very kind of forthright, not very good with words, particularly my character. So we shot these. We were lucky that we had a rehearsal. We went in, we had a rehearsal day, and then we went in to shoot it. And there was 6 episodes that they did for this lockdown, to note that lockdown has happened or that the COVID has happened. So we did these, and as to my knowledge, we were the first TV production company to do this. So I think, you know, we paved the way for the first time, I think.
Yeah.
And I have had various actors who work in various parts of the industry. There's a guy who's working on the Batman film, and he was going, how did you do it? What's happening? You know, because everybody's keen to know how you do it. And they've just been really strict to ITV. With the 2 meter, with a stick and things like that, and keep making sure everybody is kept.
Is the canteen running?
No. So if you were to go in now for lunch, you have a lunch packet, which you pick up. There's a menu sent to you by email, and you'll kind of go, oh, I'll have the vegetarian option, and you just go and pick it up at lunchtime.
It's good to go.
It's very different.
Now that you're sort of doing a bit, do you have to kind of exercise your skills every day, sort of thing, or do you just sort of, you know, you've got to sort of learn lines and stuff when you do it? But now that you're only able to turn up, maybe, how do you sort of look after yourself as an actor? How do you sort of keep your do you sort of practice stuff in here on your own or what?
I've just always, everybody looks at it, approaches it differently. I have to look at scripts days before. There's certain actors who work on the show who can look at things and act before because they can't retain lines for that long. But for me, I need to look at them a good few nights before. So the scripts are still, we're still doing the scripts. Now we've dropped the lockdown episodes. Now we're back into the normal episodes. But I think there was a friend of mine the day who's an avid fan, and I spoke to him, and he kind of said, "Well, those lockdown episodes were terrible because now it's just gone back to normal. So it's like we've had the COVID, but now they're back in the pub." But what happened was, as we went into lockdown, we'd kind of half done a set of episodes, and then they stopped them. Then they did the lockdown episodes and they put those out. And then they put the other half of
on the
that
other side, like
on the other side. So
there's something a bit kind of un.
And I think you've just got to. I just think like everything, when people do watch, continuing dramas, soaps, you've got to have a little bit, suspend your disbelief. One, because it's a village or a street where a lot of crazy things happen. But two, you know, we're shooting all year round, and sometimes the blocks take 2 or 3 weeks, and people are, I think, people are always quick to kind of criticise, aren't they, you know, especially with the world of social media now. And what I mean by that is they'll go, oh, are they not socially distancing? Now they are socially distancing. It's like, well, there's been a pandemic and we've done our best to work around it. Please be lenient. You know, likewise, when it's winter time and you get an episode or a block where it was snowing and then it was really sunny at the end. So a guy's walked out of the pub and it's gone into snow, and then the next thing you've seen another guy that was shot at the end of it and it's bright sunshine. And somebody's gone, why, what's happened to the weather in Emmerdale? It's like, we shot it over 3 weeks. You know, but that's just, that is the world of television, isn't it? But, you know, we've just not got enough of a budget to get, I don't know if you ever, there's been a company once, Mick, who came in because they needed it to be like winter. So this company came in and frosted the whole outside, and it was like, I was like, what are they using? And they were just using icing sugar. But the best bit about this company, and I think they're quite big in the industry, I think they don't just work on soaps and dramas, they work in film. They're called Snow Business, which is the best name, isn't it? You
know? No ambiguity there.
Yeah.
So what have you and Zoe done then? You know, I mean, like, you know, like when you're not kind of minding your children, how have you sort of escaped from, like, sort of lockdown? I mean, apart from walking your dog, have you been making bread or knitting or something?
Well, we like cooking a lot, so we've done a lot of that. We've had a group of friends that we do a weekly quiz Zoom with, which has been always a good thing to look forward to.
It's quite common, that, isn't it? Zoom quizzes, I think.
But generally, you know, we've got on each other's nerves at times, but because we've been together for such a long time, we know each other so well, so we know that happens, and that happens even without a lockdown situation. I think.
So how do you manage when, like, you've had a, like, because you're on set and maybe things aren't good because you've had a row and stuff.
Yeah.
So how do you sort of
navigate that?
How do you navigate? Then you have to go home together and you have to cook
well, a meal together. I don't think we're not the kind of people to harbour grudges. So I can honestly say that we've never had one of those times where we've been on set and gone, speaking to you at the moment. That's never really happened. So
just to be clear, like, because some of the listeners might not realise, so you're both on the show.
Yes, so Zoe plays Rona, she plays the vet in Emmerdale, but the beauty of her character, my character, is that she works in a kind of a different part of the village to me, or with a different set of people in the village than me, so I very rarely work with her.
Hmm.
So I only ever see her sometimes in a Woolpack scene, and it's fine. I think people kind of know that we're all right, and people know us quite well at work because we've been there for a while. So
yeah, it's really strange because I'm sitting here opposite you, and you play Kay and Dingle, and Dingle is like, I can remember seeing. So I'm on the I do some extra work on the show with you, and that's part of my earning. I do my gigs. Most people know me as somebody who performs and does kind of comedy, rock and roll, stand up. Yeah. Plus, some people know me as the guy who draws on brown paper bags around Leeds. But also, I've kind of, when the weather's been harsh, and when I've had sort of 20, 25 years of whatever as an extra on Emmerdale, you know, and it's and your character is the villain. Is the Rasputin, the Black Arts, and yet it's really strange to meet you, because the character.
Well, you've seen me more on set, being this moody person who. We chat, but it's very
gurning and eyebrows
scowling. Going, yeah, that's why that'd be creasing between. Yeah. I was looking at you there, going, Jesus, I think that's just years of playing this character and being just generally perplexed with the world, you know.
Yeah.
But but
it's just weird because the persona is very mild mannered and very, you know, and just very placid.
Yeah.
And it's so freaky. Because yeah. people get that to me, they say when I'm on stage, you know, yeah. say, oh God, you were looking at me through the whole set, and I said I wasn't, you know, I've just got big eyes, you know, yeah. I just yeah. have starry eyes. I'm a coward, yeah. a physical coward, you know, and they see me yeah. on stage, and they just see this, they're going, how come, you're not the same?
No.
How yeah. you know, you're really different, you know, yeah. you're really shy.
Yeah, same. That's the same. I'm very like that, but it's funny. I think I was blessed or not blessed with a thick pair of eyebrows and probably a scowl that I didn't even realise was happening on my face. Because, like you say, at school, I was known as a pretty. There would have been people I knew from my senior school that may have watched Emmerdale since and gone, well, that's Jeff Percy. I used to give him grief at school. Do you know what I mean? He's right, soft ass. But I also would have, you know, in between, you move from one class to another, you know, the bell goes, and then you move from science to English or something, and you're all walking in the corridor, bags are flying, and
yeah.
people are, but you, I just used to get on with my day and go to where I was going, and then I'd see my mates at lunchtime, and go, what was up with you between science and English? And go, what? You're looking at me like you wanted to kill me, and I'd be like, sorry, I didn't even realize, you know, but it's just because I've got this kind
eyebrows.
Of it's just the eyebrows and my eyes, it's nothing I can do about
yeah,
it. So,
yeah. It's like Johnny Rotten, I mean, he's got this sort of psychotic stare, but he actually was a medical condition, he had yeah. sort of like something wrong with his he had like some child, you know, some difficulties like polio or something
right,
when he was a
right.
kid, and it affected his you know, his features,
yeah, the way he looks.
So
yeah.
and he wasn't, you know, but anyway, I'm looking at you, I'm sitting in this lovely shed which is
my
man cave, but I'm looking at, you've got Steve Mason on the wall behind
yes.
you, and
I just loved that artwork on that poster.
Yeah,
I mean, the gig was brilliant, and I loved the Beta band.
Yeah, me too, you know.
I mean, when those...
That's that EP of
the three EPs came
out.
That's
astonishing, that.
Yeah, it
yeah.
really blew my mind, that. Because obviously, you know, I absolutely love music, and the Brudenell and Nathan and stuff like that, it's like a second home to me. In fact, I was 50 this year, and I was seriously thinking about trying to have a big party at the Brudenell, but it's going to have to wait for another time, I think. But, that's... one of the
so who have you seen at the Brudenell then that's floated your board?
Do you know, I've never seen you, that's the one thing. I keep saying I'm going to come,
maybe,
and I never turn up.
Well, maybe we're not, maybe you're not meant to see
no
them,
I am
maybe,
I am,
it'd just be too confusing for you.
I am, and it's always Christmas time when because my family live in Scotland and Zoe's family live in Essex. It's always, you're always on over Christmas, aren't you? Like, I'll come to that, and it's like, I can't come to that one because we're in Essex.
We were at Latitude as well. You missed me at Latitude.
I missed you. I didn't know you were on. I didn't even know you were on at Latitude. That's the thing. But Brudenell, I've seen kind of things like the, you know, gone from like the Zombies, the Pretty Things, Georgie Fame, you know, those kind of old classics.
So that's your sort.
To kind of Steve Mason, to Herman June, to... You know, have you not heard Herman June?
No.
So I think they're like a French Scandinavian band, but really lo-fi and very witty lyrics. In fact, the Brudenell Social Club, the bear thing, that was drawn by, I think, the guy who's in Herman June.
Oh, right.
I think Nathan really likes them, and I came across them quite a few years ago, and there's an album called Giant, and it just really struck a chord with me, and it kind of quickly moved into my, you know, like, top tens. You know, like, you have, you know, I can never say what's your favourite album, but I can kind of reel a few out. If you just went top 10 albums, you go, okay, this, you know,
yeah.
and that kind of moved into there, so you should check them out. Herman June, Giant.
Yeah. And Defunk as well. Daft Punk.
Daft Punk, yeah.
Yeah.
I
like the poster. That's the first album, like Defunk.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. I got my
was it Homework? It's Homework, the first album. I think Defunk is on it, isn't it? Something
I think
like
so,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Because I got my girlfriend, Kath, she's into stuff like the Pete Bog Fair, or she's into kind of like Pete Bog Fairies and bloody kind of world music and warm-out stuff.
Right.
And she wasn't into kind of house music or that kind of funk club stuff. But she, I don't know what happened, but I must have put my foot down, but she started to get the Daft Punk virus, and yeah, she's like, yeah. And she bought, and I remember getting her into Half Man Half Biscuit, this band from the Wirral,
who are
and she was saying, oh, it's lads, it's just lads, they're just so annoying,
yeah,
you know, because I was playing these songs about everybody's doing the Bob Ganlis dance.
Yeah.
She said it's lad stuff, and then about sort of within sort of a month, she was like, I was buying her half Man Half Biscuit albums, and like she knows all the songs now. God gave us life.
Now we've got.
So you do a bit of DJing as well, I believe. I do.
Yeah, that's been my one. That's been advice in lockdown. I've been lucky enough to be able to afford an old pastime of mine and reignite it, which is buying vinyl again. So I've suddenly been buying vinyl all the time because there was. I used to DJ at a club in Manchester called the Rock and Roll Bar years ago.
So what sort of stuff would you be playing?
So it was a guy who ran one of the nights at Hacienda, and he came up with this idea in 1996 to kind of do a club where, you know, like when you come home from a club after house music and then you just go and you play everything. You'd put on, you wouldn't just go on and carry on listening to house music.
Mm.
You'd listen to hip hop, you'd listen to maybe a bit of guitar music, maybe put some Pink Floyd on, the music would just start to, you put funk on. And,
yeah.
And that's what the Rock and Roll Bar became, this kind of melting pot of different sounds, and that was really up my street at the time. So it was a kind of guitar 60s.
So where was that then?
South Nightclub.
Right.
It was great. 96. Now I think I started, maybe it was 94 it started. I think I started in 96.
Yeah.
And I carried on DJing there until about 2000. Yeah, I did about 10 years there, and it was great. But we had some incredible guests on there over the years. We had John Peel twice, and so I was lucky enough to kind of
a rock club then. It was.
Yeah, well, it was everything really. You know, Daft Punk would sit next to Northern Soul, would sit next to the Teenage Kicks, would sit next to the Stone Roses. You know, it was everything, reggae. It was everything and anything.
Were you acting at that time as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the amount of actors who, like in Manchester, because it was quite near the Royal Exchange, there would be friends of friends in plays. And I've met many actors who I've seen since and gone, I came to that club that you used to DJ. And, you know, it was really good that people used to. I think it was quite a little institution for the people that went to this club, you know. And like I say, it was of a certain standard that we got really fast, you know, brilliant guests.
Mm. And how did that lead into you starting on Emmerdale? How did that all happen?
But what were you doing? Were you acting? What were you doing before Emmerdale then, in 96 then? What sort of stuff were you doing?
Well, I think I graduated in 96. No, I didn't. I graduated in 96, and that's when I used to DJ at parties at drama school, you know, like house parties. Mm. I mean, like someone's house, that kind of thing. So suddenly, after leaving drama school, I suddenly realised that acting wasn't going to make me a lot of money, and I needed to do other things. I couldn't just sign on and wait for a job to happen. So I literally went round some bars in Manchester with a cassette, which is how old it was, a mixed cassette, and passed it on to bars in Manchester. And then I DJed at 10 Bar, and then the next thing I was DJing at this rock and roll bar, this club in Manchester.
Mm.
And then, what's the other place? Was it the board? Was it the boardwalk? The Boardwalk, yeah, it's not there anymore now, is it the Boardwalk? I did a night there as well. So I was doing that, and then I was starting to act, and acting didn't take off massively to begin with.
Mm. Was it telly you were doing, or was it like?
I was doing everything. I was doing theatre, I was doing radio, I was doing telly, but I was doing bit parts on telly. So by the time I'd come to Emmerdale, which was 2000, I was 4 years out. and I'd probably done about 10 TV jobs, but, you know, maybe six of them were like a copper in two scenes, you know what I mean, or a nightclub manager in Coronation Street. So there's
you've got like a sort of a grounding then, you just...
Yeah. So I kind of did...
Your push-ups, basically.
Yeah, just to, yeah, I did. So and Emmerdale, very quickly, the work accelerated or being on a set accelerated because you were doing it day in, day out. So, you know, I managed to learn a lot then. But the audition came along in 2000 and... I went for the meeting. I remember kind of looking at the breakdown, and it was kind of like Manchester throwback. And I was like, "Oh, here we go."
Is that what you?
that was the character breakdown. Was a Manchester throwback with a Mancunian haircut, and at the time I had a long kind of haircut because, you know, I suppose because it was from Manchester. And and so yeah, I know on paper I was like, "All right, this is quite positive on paper." So all I'm gonna have to do is go in there and make sure that I can do it. And I do remember going into the audition and seeing the producer, and this has only happened twice in my career where you can literally see, and I sound like I'm full of myself here, but he's almost like his eyes popped out of his head because I think
he saw
what was on the page and I thought, oh, this seems promising. And sure enough, I read it and then I got a recall and then I got the job. But it was sometimes I think there is, you know, when you hear that right place, right time.
Yeah, no, I think so, because some actors, like, it doesn't matter what you sort of, I've kind of met a few actors here and there, and they said that, you know, we go to 50, 60 auditions and it doesn't matter what your history is, whether you've done Shakespeare, Beckett, blah, blah, blah. If you're not what they want, it doesn't matter how much dues you paid.
Yeah.
It can be a kid who's just been acting for 3 weeks or walks, and they just say, "Sorry, Ian McKellen, I've been the Donald here."
Yeah.
Because he's the paper boy. He works.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then you just have Ian McKellen has to just do the walk of shame.
Yeah. No, that's true.
So it's like, there's a lot of walking of shame. You know, there's, you know, people, all these stars are there and they're, they're living this cosseted life, but you've got to have a constitution like iron to take the refusals and to just be sort of bat around the floor and stuff. Yeah. I suppose
it's more about knockbacks than being actually, you know, you might have 12 auditions in a year and you get three of them, and the amount of the one that got away I could tell you about, you know, when you've got penciled in or you've almost got the job and then. The programme goes out or the play goes out and then you go, could have been me, but
so
it just wasn't, you know.
So what happened, why was there a gap between 2000 and the space between you coming on doing Kane, and then there was a gap in between when you left for a while?
Oh, you mean I did in Emmerdale?
In Emmerdale,
so I did 2000, 2006, and I think I just got to a point where I wanted to, because I'd only been 4 years out of drama school, so I kind of thought, this is the, I haven't kind of ticked all the boxes I want to tick. There was some little places that I wanted to work in London and things like that, and I left kind of wanting to kind of fulfil those things, and I did 3 years out there and I managed to kind of do that, but also I've got Zoe who had looked after our daughter for a few years and stopped working. So we kind of said that whoever got the biggest job once I'd left, so that if she got a bigger job, then I would look after the children. Yeah. And sure enough, that happened. Zoe ended up being in Coronation Street for a year and I sat back and looked after the kids for about a year as well. So there's a year where I was only maybe doing radio plays, or I think I did a play and a radio play, or a couple of radio plays.
So how did you feel about, I guess, if you get the opportunity to be a character in a soap, because they're so big nationally and internationally, and people perceive you as being that character. How does that feel for you to think, right, I'm going to be known from now on as this person, and my own identity is going to be a bit anonymous?
I really never imagined it being what it's become. I remember driving over the M62 in 2000. because obviously I knew who the Dingles were. And there was a little bit of a kind of like driving there, just driving over to the studios at Emmerdale and going, oh my God, I'm going to be a Dingle. You know, it was a real kind of shock because I knew who Zach was and I knew who Marlon was and Butch, and they were quite an iconic family.
Did you watch it before?
I hadn't watched it as a fan, but I just knew them and I'd been fascinated by them because they were kind of the underclass, weren't they? And I liked what we stood for. So
the weeds.
Yeah, so to be joining that family was quite exciting for me. But Johnny, I never really thought about whether it would turn into this part that it's turned into.
Mm.
The contract was initially for 3 months and another 3 months and then the 3 months after that. And then once I got to the end of the year, then they offered me a year. And then it's been like that.
How long have you been on the show then? Now?
So I did those almost 16, 17. I joined in 2000, left in 2006, joined again in 2009. And so 17 years.
Wow.
So do you get a chance to sort of like slip off and do other little projects?
Do you know what I did in my first 6 years? I was really lucky that the producers let me go out and do three plays. So I did two plays over at the Bolton Octagon. Mm. One that was a play that I'd always wanted to do, which is I've been fascinated with this kind of Strindberg, which is a kind of, you know, from the Chekhov period, very naturalistic, but it's about a butler and the young daughter of the house on a Midsummer Eve, and he's the kind of head butler and she's the daughter of the family that he works for, and then there's this night where they, and it's all about him trying to
break the glass ceiling to
get from the working classes up to the top house.
Yeah.
There's a potential to sort of like a connection between two classes.
Yeah, I'd always connected that upstairs down thing, you know, which is what's it called? Downton. It's, you know, it was like that, but 10 times better. You know, the players, and the both the characters just end up messed up at the end of the play, but it's pretty much a two-hander. So I was lucky that I got the chance to do that. Then there was another play that I was fascinated with, which Steve Halliwell, actually, who plays that Dingle, knows David Halliwell, who wrote this play that back in the late 70s, I think, it's called Little Malcolm and His Struggle Against the Eunuchs, and it's just about these Northern art students and just this madcap story that they have, and they all listen to jazz, but it's very, very wacky and funny. And I think it was done at the Royal Court at the time, and then this David Halliwell was going to be a great writer, and I think Steve worked with him on his second play, and I just think the guy just never kind of produced the work that he did with Little Malcolm, you know.
Are you from an acting family then?
No.
Just somebody you wanted to study?
All I know is my granddad was in the Navy and he was a bit of a singer. My nan's always been. My granddad never saw me kind of perform on stage or anything, so I think she was always like, that's your granddad, that. she's a proper McNana, is my nan, and she's like your granddad. Yeah, that's you get that from your granddad. You get your singing from your granddad. Not that I've got a great voice, but
so
you
do
know.
You sing then?
I can sing, yeah. And I have done, I did Oh What a Lovely War, and I did Animal Farm, which is more, So Animal Farm is
a musical.
It's got music in it, but it's like a Brechtian type music. Mm-hmm. So it's not you sing the song and it tells the story, and then you just carry on acting. You don't sing the song, wait for the applause, and then carry on. Yeah. You sing the song and just carry on. That's like Oh What a Lovely War.
Hmm.
It's not. It's meant to hit you around the face. It's not. You don't break the fourth wall, as it were. Do you know what I mean?
Hmm.
So you just stay in it.
Have you been in a band? Have you ever sort of entertained the thought of like singing in a band?
No, I've never, but the first time ever I managed to sing last year with my cousin and his mates. We had a bit of a kind of mad, fiftieth, and his mates are all musos from bands in Scotland and quite well known bands, so they all jammed together.
Mm.
And there was probably about 12 of us, and then they every night they'd play. So we were there for about five nights, and every night they'd play because they'd had to set everything up. And on about the second or third night, the drummer was like, "Why aren't you singing?" I was like, "Sing." He's like, "Is it not a song that you could sing?" And I was like, "Yeah, I suppose." Because he said, "Come on, everyone's having a go." There were guys who weren't bass players getting up and playing bass. Yeah. Everyone was shaking something off.
Just having a go,
yeah. You know. And there were people. So I went, "All right, tomorrow I'll do it." So I got up and I sung, which is on the wall there, at Moon Age Daydream, and I sung it. And these guys are all really, you know, kind of well-known established musicians. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were just like, "Fucking hell, you know, where have you been hiding that?" And I was like, they were really genuine, you know what I mean? And so I must have sung in tune, but
it's great.
To play with a live band, it was so exhilarating. Do you know what I mean? And I was a bit drunk as well because we'd had a few drinks, so I think I was relaxed and I just had a great time, you know.
Yeah,
yeah. It's great to sort of hear your own voice because when I first started out, I was doing like kind of stand-up-y stuff, and it was just talking and poems and stuff. I used to go to the Frog and Bucket in Manchester back in the 90s and stuff, and I was doing kind of poems and that. And my mate said he had a piano in his house back in sort of like 2000, and he just said, come and sing some Lionel Richie and some Sting.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, not for me. That's not my, you know, yeah. Elton John. No, he said, yeah, just come. There they are. There's the songs. There's Rocket Man there. Yeah. There's Every Breath You Take. And there's Hello. You know, I thought, I'm not seeing it. And there's Peter Gabriel, blah, blah. So, not my music at all. But anyway, started to play the piano, and then I went for it.
Yeah.
And I felt like somebody else was like pushing me out of my body.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't recognise that voice. And he was going, "Man," he says, "that's really..." And Johnny sort of gave me confidence to sing, you know.
Yeah.
He just said, "You know, you've got a voice."
Yeah.
And I kind of... It's just finding the confidence.
Yeah.
You know, because you think, well, no, I'll stick to what I'm good at, which is I draw and I do poems and I'm canny and trying to be witty and stuff. I'll do that stuff. But when you sing it, I think there's a case of you have to... There's no hiding place.
Yeah.
You can't fake us. Well, I don't know what... But I know that when I was doing it, I felt really kind of a flush.
Yeah.
I felt totally exposed.
Yeah.
But it was quite delicious.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was good. It was a good moment, actually, because, you know, it was only last year. And one of the guys who was there, something kind of came of that night, and he's kind of been writing some musical in the West End, and he was like, "I've got this idea. Would you come and work on one of the workshops for this musical that we're doing?" I was like, "Oh." And then they told me some of the names that it was involved in, and I was a bit like, kind of almost want to go, "I'm Justin Emmerdale," and he went, "You know, sod that, I want you to come and do it." So I went away from that weekend just going, "Oh my God, this has been a real eye-opener for me." Right. So obviously I know I can sing in tune, but it's made me go, maybe there will be a time in my career in the future where I might get on the stage in the West End and sing. And not it'd have to be that I'm more of a satirical musical man, you know what I mean? I like something that's a bit tongue-in-cheek and a bit daft.
Yeah.
You know, like the Python stuff would have been... In fact, that was a one that got away kind of thing. I nearly did Spamalot years ago. That kind of thing, I think, would be more up my street in terms of a musical rather than something like, I don't know, something that's all a bit showy, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Cats.
Do you think
Cats? Yeah, Cats, which is apparently a great film.
Yeah, how different do you think it'd be now if you were starting out now? Like the chances you'd have to work at your craft and work in bars and DJs, because it seems like a lot of themes that you hear from people on the radio is, you know, when I'm in my 40s, mixing 60s or only 50s, we had time to sort of be a musician, be an actor, and we could sign on. And it seems very different now. You even hear people like Brian Eno, big name, saying, you know, if you want to be in the arts, you need to have time, and you can't, you need to give it time. But there's a lot of pressure on young people to be working and, you know, get on the career ladder. So do you think if you were 21 now starting out, I think it'd be a very different landscape?
I think it would, yeah. I think it'd be a lot harder. I think there seems to be a pressure. Certainly looking at some of the younger actors that come into the TV industry, it's all about social media, it would seem. Mm. You know what I mean? That's about kind of to create a buzz about yourself and to kind of get your numbers up or get your profile up. And for me, it's something that sits real. I don't really like all that kind of side of it. So to have to try and feel like I need to get on that, otherwise I might not be helping my career, would really trouble me and make me probably want to pull away from it.
Mm.
And for that reason, maybe I wouldn't be successful if I was in nowadays. But I was lucky that I did these years of because I say I had two really tough years, to the point, which I didn't talk about before, but I had two tough years where I was going to give it up. Do you know what I mean? The first 2 years of acting, of leaving drama school, was so not much work at all.
Mm.
And it was thanks to my wife, Zoe, and thanks to my mum, and thanks to my uncle John, who just kind of said, you know, you've worked 3 years at drama school, why are you giving it up? Because I was just frustrated with the, you know, sitting on your backside and not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a period where the phone was going more for DJing than it was for acting, which I look back on now and go, you should have enjoyed that more, but I was too busy wanting to be an actor.
Mm.
But now I get to DJ every now and then. I get wheeled out for 40th and 50th, and occasionally I get asked to do the odd cool bar.
Would you play at EastEnders party then?
No, I think I played played at a Soap Awards 1 year, and I went over and played a couple of songs, but I was like, this isn't for me, you know what I mean?
You'd have the headphones on and you'd be just spinning and you'd be getting the drop down.
Yeah.
I think with what we all do in arts and culture, there's no sort of definitive jumping through hoops, is there? Because I met Mick when he was in his 50, I guess, and so I guess this is your music.
You know, I ended up on, with my foot on the amps at 50.
Yeah.
And it just seemed stupid.
Is that when it started for you? Yeah.
Well, I couldn't believe that I was holding a microphone and singing with a guitar behind me. You know, yeah. I mean, this is what I wanted to do when I was like 14. I wanted to be in Free or Deep Purple or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it took me to like, I'm 50 and there's these kids screaming in front of me, got absolutely mad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going, what the
hell? How did they get here?
What the hell?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It just seems so preposterous.
Yeah.
But as I say, you just, it's there. So you can't do anything about it. It's not in your control. Mm. You know, there you are. You wanted to be a singer. There you are. There's a microphone. Sing. And learn.
It happens at different times, doesn't it, for people, I think. There's no like definitive time if your career is going to start. It might start when you're late in life, middle of life, start of life. Mm. And
it's just wonderful, the chaos of a career.
Yeah.
You know, because I did a degree in theology. I was going to be an RE teacher in the 90s, and I'd been working on the buildings for 4 or 5 years before that. I did fine art at Bradford College, and I was selling bloody raffle tickets on the street for the British Heart Research or something. Yeah. You know, just selling lottery tickets. And then I ended up selling ties in Merrion Centre with an ironing board, you know, 6 ties for £1.
Yeah.
Because I got sick of being on the dole, and I started to perform in the middle of Merrion Centre and make my rent. And then it was, I'm a dad.
Yeah.
And I'm out drawing on paper bags. And I'm thinking, why am I drawing on paper bags? Why am I making life so difficult?
Yeah.
Why can't I just get some decent cartridge paper and just sit in a studio and let people come to me? Why do I have to go out there to this awful pub where the people are just really obnoxious and they're going to, and it'll hurt me and draw them?
Yeah.
Why, I'm in Biro, what the, are you completely masochistic, you know, but it just kind of, it felt right.
Yeah.
You know, some things feel right. You just think, this is it. I'm basically, for better or for worse, this is what I am.
Yeah.
I'm a whatever. You know, I'm just an old pussycat. I'm out there just sniffing around looking for a bit of grub.
Yeah.
So would it be, is it turned out like you thought it would in that sense? Because you must think, all right, I'm an actor, like, in the sense that you're acting.
It's gone through various stages of, you know, you kind of do, at kind of drama school, you're a young kid. I was a kind of more of a mature, I was still young, I was 23 to 26, but I was certainly not one of the kids that straight from school at 18, 19, who were at university. I'd worked at various places. I'd done that kind of travelling around Europe thing. I'd done that summer in Greece, and, you know, I'd worked in an accounts office, a shirt and tie, which I knew wasn't for me. I'd worked at WH Smith Do It All. I'd worked in a record shop. I'd done all these different things. So when I kind of left drama school, I had these, you know, I want to do this, I want to do a British film, I want to work in at the Royal Court, I want to do this, I want to do that. And then within a year or two, I was like, that's not happening for me, you know what I mean? And that's not really going to happen. So then 2 years later, because, you know, I'll be honest, that I was like, again, coming out of drama school, call it a snobbishness, because you're all talking about what you want to do and what art you want to do and how you want to do it and where you want to do it. And, you know, soaps were definitely not on the agenda. And also an advert wasn't on the agenda. And then within 4 years, I'd done three adverts and I was joining a soap. And in my head, I was like, I'm doing this for 2 years and then I'm out. Mm. 6 years later, 6 years flew by. I absolutely loved it. And then I had those 3 years out and then did lots of theatre again, which kind of fed my soul again. Although I'd managed to do three plays, like I said before, in the first 6 years of Emmerdale. And then I came back and then I kind of sat back and relaxed on it a bit more, and because I think I'd also spent, to my contemporaries from drama school, from the days at drama school with those mates, the first 6 years of Emmerdale, I think I was always going, yeah, I know it's a soap, but, and now I kind of think it's just been the best job for me, and it's been such a great experience from start to finish. And ironically, some of those friends that might have been a bit snobby, like myself, are now kind of going, can you have a word with the producer to get me? Because we've all grown up and we've got families, and I realise now that the stability that Emmerdale, I never thought I'd have an house. I never thought I'd have a mortgage. But things have changed, and now I look back
at it. How has Kane changed since, you know, how has he did? And have you had a different, how's he changed? Have you got a different writer now?
I think, do you know, I think the 3 years out was the best thing that ever happened for the character, because that it created more layers, because he went off to Spain, he'd nicked loads of money and he went to Spain and then he came back. And I think the producer at the time suddenly thought, I want to integrate him into the village, because before that he was just this lone kind of maverick who lived above the Dingles and grunted at people and didn't speak to anybody apart from his family. So that in itself was not a realistic existence in a village. People would just, after a while, go, just ignore him as an idiot. And I think they did in those, you know, by the time we got to 6 years, I realised that I was just repeating and doing the same kind of scowling around corners and things like that. So when I came back, the producer said, I'm going to put him in the garage, I'm going to make him more accessible in the village, and I'm going to have him having a few plans friends. So he's more of a realistic human being, do you know what I mean? So that's what we did, and I think...
Sorry, it's just run out there.
No, fine.
I just set this running. Are you? Is yours stopped?
I think, I think mine's still going.
Okay.
I hope.
Go for it.
Still going, look at it.
So, and then Gavin Blythe, this producer, who's no longer with us, sadly, he was just a brilliant guy, and he... I feel he kind of reinvented him by putting him in the garage and making him more accessible, and then he became more of a family man, and as the years have gone on, he's mellowed, but quite rightly mellowed, because you know, the older you get, you do mellow. Yeah. And that's realistic. And I think sometimes you see people who love the show and they go, I prefer him when he was nastier. And it's like, but it's not realistic, is it?
Yeah.
Because if he was like that all the time, certainly within a few years, he'd do something so bad that he'd have to get written out of the show.
Yeah, because so, I mean, soaps are known for like mirroring contemporary culture. So if people are mellowing as they get older, that's going to be reflected in the soaps character, right?
Yeah.
And did you ever think you'd... Was it in one of the Red Top tabloids where it had a free Deirdre thing when Deirdre got sent to prison in Coronation Street? And it's funny how... It's interesting how soap characters become real people beyond characters. Did you ever think that might happen to you? Or?
I don't know, but I think for some people who watch them, they are. You know, I think they are. They can be that. They're certainly a form of escapism that people like. And if you you stay in the show for long enough, I think people warm to your character. I know that people won't have liked my characters to start with, but now he's been in it that long, I think that any other villains come in, I think they're like, Kane will sort him out. Do you know what I mean? So I've become this kind of anti-hero almost, you know what I mean? That kind of will sort out the other wrong ones that come in the show. Because I've been there for long enough.
Big daddy.
You know? Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. So who have you... I've looked at... I've sat there and I've watched people... I've sketched little people while I've been sort of sitting on my chair. And I've watched people like Freddie...
Yeah,
the old guy,
Jones.
Freddie Jones, and I just remember him from like Hammer horror films and
amazing.
Stuff. And he's just his fruity delivery.
Yeah,
and he was so yummy.
Yeah,
I wanted to eat him. And
yeah,
he was like a big cake.
Yeah,
of he was rich.
Yeah,
and you could smell life off him. You could smell humiliation. You know, dodgy dealings, love, everything.
Yeah.
You know, he just radiated.
Yeah.
You know, he burned with life. And what's it like when somebody like that turns up? You know, because it's quite surprised. Like Patrick Moore turned up. You know, and there's a Patsy Kensit turned up. They're from like sort of like across the stream or something. You know, it's really surprising to sort of see them in this thing. How come he's in Emmerdale? You know, because he's like...
Well, Michael Praed, who came in recently, he was, you know, certainly a period in my life where my mother was watching Robin the Hooded Man, and then he went on into Dynasty.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Michael Praed, and the lovely, and then when they're somebody like Michael as well, who's just so such a beautiful man and a great person.
There's a sparkle that comes. There's something a bit exotic
that
happens in the, you know, which is probably a good thing, I suppose. Maybe there's it's considered. You know, well, yeah, that'll do. That will add a bit of spice to, you know, this next few months, whatever.
Yeah,
I suppose that because they're a kind of rolling thing. You get young actors and you get really established actors coming in and coming out, and it's this continuing thing that's almost like a perpetual thing. So it's great for that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think the people that come in, I mean, I think people are, actors are found on there and come to notoriety on there, and then some move on and some stay there. And then young actors come in and cut the teeth and then move on and go into other things. And then, you know, some older actors from, like you say, from what seemed like across the pond and from a different kind of, a different stratosphere almost come in and you go, the amount of actors, you know, industry people that went, am I right? Is Freddie Jones in Emmerdale? And you're like, yes, he is. And they're like, oh my God, wow. You know, and like you say, Mick, to watch him there, sometimes his delivery, you go, that is so massive. But everything had such intention. Every vowel, consonant, everything was hit and had and was just delivered beautifully. And it was just a joy to sit and watch. And he would sit sometimes and just, I mean, it sounds such like an actor thing to do, but you'd just be mesmerised. He'll just literally go on, say one of the sonnets, one of Shakespeare's sonnets, and just reel it off, and they're all there in his brain. They're all there, and they just
and he'd do some kind of Frankie Howard, he'd just drop a line,
something
just kind of cheeky and witty, of course, darling.
And
it was so lovely, you know, but it was just kind of what it needed sometimes, you know, just kind of brought a little strangeness to, you know, the wool pack.
Yes, no, to the wool pack, exactly.
The flags of this transvestite, darling.
Yeah, he's great.
Jeff, have you got a recommended album for this week?
What? Just a recommended album? Just a go-to?
It doesn't have to be your favourite one, you know. It can just something that's kind of cooking in the back of the oven. that you might have been singing about 3 days ago.
I'd have to look on my phone to see what I've been listening.
Just make it up.
If I was going to go to a go to kind of classic for me would be something like the Village Green Preservation Society by the Kinks.
It's
just a great English album.
I've never heard it, but my ambition is to buy it. I've always thought, because it's a double album, isn't it? It's all about, is it?
Just about
Cricklewood, is it?
It's just about England. It's just very English. And at this time of the year, when you've got a bit of sun, it's a great album.
That would be an album for now. Yeah. That would be a perfect way to just sit and just.
Yeah.
And ponder,
yeah.
And I'll just stick it on. Ray Davies on now.
Yeah.
Two sides of that, four sides. Oh, thanks, Jeff, for coming on the Ego Podcast, and thanks to you listeners for tuning in. Jeff Hordley and Zoe, his wife, have done a short film on CBBC about the benefits of gardening, and further details can be found at Twitter at Hordley Jeff, Facebook Jeff Hordley UK. You can listen to this again and download this podcast on iTunes, Mick Artistic's Ego Podcast. Further links can be found on our website, mickartistic.com. See you on the road and on the waves next time. Bye.